one of the things about writing a novel when you've been a bookseller, an editor, a publisher, and a literary agent is you finally get to understand how hard writing is. And I've been so nice to my clients since I wrote this book, I can tell you. And I think they appreciate it. This book is set in the late 1950s in Somerset. It's about a family who have gone bankrupt. Jim Palmer had a Jaguar dealership in Bath, and he's gone bust, and they've moved to a farmhouse in the countryside. And they've really come down in the world, and they're all trying to come to terms with their new life. And it's sort of a father and son story, and Billy, the boy who's 10 years old, is really, I suppose, the main character. So I'll read two scenes which are seen from his point of view. And then if there's time, maybe I'll read another one, but I don't know. They're quite short. By the end of Billy's first week at school, he and Alan were friends. One morning, Alan came by the farmhouse and they set off across the fields. Billy hadn't been sure where he was able to go, but Alan wandered freely, so he simply followed. They walked through an apple orchard, and Alan told him that scrumping time would come soon. What's scrumping? Stealing apples. Is it allowed? Said Billy, feeling immediately foolish. Of course it isn't. That's the point. We'll do it with Frank and the rest of the gang. He'll tell us when. They crossed a stile and came into the field where Foss's cows were pastured. Will they chase us? Said Billy. Watch. Alan began to run straight at them. They scattered before him, and he ran back to Billy with an exultant expression on his face. See, he said, scaredy cows. At the top of Folly Lane, there was a birch copse. Alan led the way to a place at the edge from where they could see the countryside stretching before them. It was crisscrossed by ditches that ran very straight alongside tracks and hedges. Are they canals? Said Billy. They're called rhines. Rhines? No, Rhines, R-H-Y-N-E-S. Glastonbury Tor dominated everything, a pyramid on the plain. So what do you know about the Tor? Said Billy. It's where King Arthur's buried, isn't it? King Arthur of the Round Table? Yes. I thought he lived in Camelot, but he died here. Avalon, they called it. Billy's eyes returned to the Tor. Have you been there? He said. My dad took me there in the milk lorry once. You can see for miles. Do you think your dad would take me there? Maybe. They lapsed into silence for a moment. Alan sucked on a blade of grass and said, My dad says all this used to be under the sea, and Avalon was an island. You mean when he was a kid? No, a long time ago. Hundreds of years, maybe thousands. Billy gazed at the plain. How exciting, he thought, that all this might once have been underwater. They'd have needed a boat to get to school, but then the school would have been underwater too. It was hard sometimes to account for things, for how strange the world seemed. He narrowed his eyes. Alan, he said, you know when you see colors like green and blue, do you think everybody sees the same thing? How do you mean? Well, how do I know that what I see is green, you don't see as blue? Alan thought for a moment. We've got the same eyes, haven't we? Billy looked at him, then back towards the Tor. It held his attention all the time. Come on, he said suddenly. Race you back down the hill. The Tor is a kind of symbol for Billy of all his hopes and aspirations, and it's also a symbol for Jim of his resentments. And for a very long time, Jim quite actively prevents Billy from getting to the Tor, which is sort of dream. A lot of things happen next, and later on, towards the end of the book, there is a funeral. And I will read about the funeral. Billy had never been to a funeral before, and in the car on the way to London, he tried to imagine what it might be like. He conjured up images of long hearses and hundreds of people dressed in black. Not that they themselves were dressed in black, since, as his mother had pointed out, they possessed almost nothing suitable for such an occasion. Billy looked down at the grey flannels his father had given him. They were his first ever pair of long trousers, and they felt very strange. It was almost like being in bed. She should count herself lucky we're coming at all, said Jim. Why, Daddy? Asked Sarah. Because she wrote me out of her will, that's why. What does that mean? It means she gave all her money to some charity or other. Margaret laid a hand on his arm and said, Let it be, Jim. So that was why his father had been so grumpy these past few days, thought Billy. He must have hoped for some of Aunt Bee's money. In the chapel in Brompton Cemetery, they found themselves among far fewer people than Billy had supposed. He looked around him and didn't recognize anyone. He knew that Beatrice had never married and that his father's own parents had died before he was born, but nonetheless it seemed odd that he should know no one here at all. Above his head, a plaque read, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live." The service droned on, and Billy found himself gazing at Beatrice's coffin. Did he believe in heaven, in life after death? He wasn't sure. Jesus had lived on after the crucifixion, but then he was Jesus. Did everyone go to heaven? It would be very full by now if they did. But then most people didn't go to church very often. His own family seemed to go only when they absolutely had to. Could you not go to church and still go to heaven? He decided it would be wise to go at least a few times a year, just in case. Out in the cemetery, fleeting clouds chased the sun, and the wind caught his mother's skirt and lifted it above her knees. They stood over the grave and looked on as the coffin was lowered into the earth. Magpies flitted around the gravestones, playing tag. A stone near Billy bore an inscription that read, "On earth one gentle soul the less, in heaven one angel more." That would be how they fitted into heaven. They became angels. Frank Wilmot had told him there were people who argued over how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. 6, that's what Frank's dad reckoned. As the gravedigger shoveled soil over the coffin, Billy tried to hold on to his memories of Aunt Bee. The best were the boat races and the teas. And then there were the times she came down on the train from London to stay with them, bringing presents whatever the time of year. Since his father had no sisters, she was always Aunt Bee, even though she was really a great aunt. Now there was no one left in his father's family. He looked across at Jim, who stood with his head bowed. Billy could tell he was angry with his aunt, but clearly he was sad, too. Anger and sadness seemed to go together so often, he thought. "Did she leave us anything at all?" he said when they got back into the car. "Billy, please," said his mother. "But I just remembered. She said I could have the binoculars." "You'll be getting a few things, and so will Sarah," said Jim, "but not me." Shall I read another one? Yeah, okay. Those two scenes are told from Billy's point of view. I'll read the first scene that's told from Jim's point of view. So Jim's in his late 30s, and as I say, he's humiliated by what he sees as his failure, and he can't really understand it or come to terms with it. He's got a job in a local clothes outfitters in Wells, and it's a very menial job. The shop is owned by his wife's uncle, Reg. Jim cycled past the church hall and the village shop and out onto the Launchley Road. This journey of 4 miles into Wells would now be his daily lot, his daily penance, so different from the 10-minute drive to the showroom in Bath. The road skirted the hills, passing through flat farmland. It was harvest time. Nav, having thought very much about the countryside, he must now learn to understand it. He wondered how the kids were getting on. The school seemed hardly a school at all, more a place to leave children during the day. And those spinster sisters were very odd. Well, Billy and Sarah would have to make do, just as he would have to. He cycled past apple orchards and open fields. A wood pigeon flew from a tangled hedge, startling him for a moment. He saw a large farm up ahead and smelled the sweet, raw odor of silage. Then, at a crest in the road, the facade of Wells Cathedral came into sight. He had come here once with Margaret, just before they were married, to visit her Uncle Reg and his wife. It was really a market town, he thought, not a city. The great edifice at its centre gave it airs. Reg's shop was in Market Place. Jim dismounted and pushed his bicycle along the cobbled street. At one end was a stone cross with a fountain, and at the other the bishop's eye, the gateway to the palace. This stately tranquility made him uneasy. A sign etched in gold above one of the shops read Underhills, and below, Outfitters to the Scholars and Gentry of Wells. The windows curved inwards towards a recessed door and displayed school uniforms and dull men's clothes. Jim pushed his bike into a narrow, gloomy space. "You can park it out the back," said Reg, barely looking up at him as he spoke. Catching sight of himself in a mirror, Jim hastily removed his bicycle clips. In his tweed jacket and grey flannels, he was hot and flustered after his ride. He swept back his navy brown hair and took another look at himself, at the new assistant in Underhill's outfitters. "It'll be slow for a week or two," said Reg. "You've missed the back-to-school rush, for which you should be very grateful, and nobody's thinking about winter just yet. I need to do stock-taking and accounts, so I'm going to leave the customers to you." Reg was a small, fastidious man, his grey hair crinkly and glistening with brill cream. "His eyes are too close together," thought Jim, "squint eyes. Are the prices on everything?" "There's a list," said Reg, reaching into a drawer under the till. "Here. Now, I don't want you trying to sell anything to anybody, understand? This isn't like what you're used to. If somebody wants something, they'll buy it." Jim was good at selling. The last thing he'd sold was an XK150 drop head. He had persuaded the buyer to take just about every extra going, from the Dunlop racing tires to the wood-rimmed steering wheel. If Reg didn't want Jim to sell, then more fool him. Reg went into the office at the back, leaving him alone in the shop. He looked at the price list and tried to relate it to what was on display. Everything seemed to come in a shade of grey or brown. There was nothing remotely fashionable, no modern fabrics or bright colours. The dark wood of the fixtures oppressed him, and he stood at the front of the shop, gazing out into the street at the few people who passed by. Perhaps Mondays were always quiet, he thought. It was ages before the doorbell rang. "I want a cap," said his first customer. He was florid and thick-set, a clod of a man. "Yes, sir," said Jim. "What sort of cap?" "One like this," said the man, removing a worn flat cap from his head. He examined it through thick glasses, turning it over in his hands. "Had this one 20 years. "What size is it?" "Blowed if I know. The label went a long time ago." Jim went over to the display of caps. "Try this," he said, choosing the plainest. The man tried it on in front of the mirror. "How much?" Jim returned to the counter and the list. 7 and 6, he said. "Got anything cheaper?" Jim handed him another, almost identical cap. "This one's 6 shillings. The man tried it on. "I can't see any difference," he said. Jim took the caps back. He couldn't see any difference either. "This one has a better quality lining," he said involuntarily. "It'll last longer." The man took them back and looked at the linings. "I think you're right," he said. "I'll take it." At lunchtime, Jim stepped out into the sunshine, breathing in the warm air with a sense of grateful relief. He walked through Penniless Porch, the towered archway that separated the town from the cathedral precincts, and onto the green. Sitting down on the grass, he slowly ate his sandwiches and then lay back and closed his eyes. He'd had one customer that morning and taken a trifling sum of money. Wondering how he was going to get through the afternoon, he drifted into sleep. When he awoke, it was to a thrilling, reverberant sound. The bells of the cathedral were ringing, but this was no ordinary bell ringing. It was an intricate music, full of complex harmonies. It seemed to go on forever, oceanic, washing over him. When it ended, he sat up, collected his things, and began to walk slowly back to the shop. He felt utterly stranded. Thank you.